The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Mailbag Edition. Not as Jonathan Wilson suggested, because we've run out of things to talk about, but because the first was such a riotous success. They're still talking about it somewhere, probably. So today, another panel of Galacticos discuss philosophy, Arrested on the Field of Play, the FIFA-cation of Arsene Wenger, Qatar, the point of leagues, some Arsenal, some book recommendations, players out of position, your perfect stadium, a clarification on shovels, and some wildly unnecessary praise. It's all your questions, so I can't say all that plus your questions, because it's just your questions, but it remains the Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jordan Jarrett Bryan, how are you?
Good morning, pal, or wherever you are in Australia, good afternoon. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, excellent. Thanks very much. Lars Sivertsen, welcome.
Hi, Max.
And Philippe Auclair. Nice to see you, Philippe.
Nice to see you, Max. Bonjour à toi.
Here we go. Bloody Year Gimp says, has Arsene Wenger lost his damned mind? I presume he's referring to the World Cup every 2 years. I will go straight to Philippe Auclair.
Oh, my goodness. This is not even the amuse-girl or the aperitif or the first course or whatever. You go straight for the plat de résistance.
Yeah, why not?
The Côte de Bœuf from the first minute.
The Côte de Bœuf, absolutely, with a massive side order of chips. feeling hungry now. And Sepp Blatter, I remember Brian Glanville used to say of him, he's got 10 ideas a day, 11 of them bad. And I think Gianni Infantino probably is 10 ideas a day and 15 of them bad or 100 of them bad. It's basically this idea that we have to have a two-year World Cup cycle. And the way it works is obviously Gianni Infantino is not going to talk to you, Max, or to the people at FIFA Council and say, I want a World Cup every 2 years. So you get other people to do it for you. So who do you get? You get your head of football development, Arsene Wenger, who puts it a little teaser, which gets people talking, and people saying, it's a rubbish idea. Then you go to a friendly FA, in this case, the Saudi Arabia FA. You put across the idea of a feasibility study. You don't say, oh, are we going to put it to a vote? No. Feasibility study. So that was agreed in May. Then you get some other minnows who've never qualified for a World Cup to say, actually, we think it's a really good idea. So that's the Asian Confederation. I think Nepal, Maldives, Sri Lanka and Bangladesh.
Can't say Maldives is a tough place to go, can you, on a Tuesday?
I mean, with global warming and all, it's going to be a very tough place to go in a couple of years, I suspect.
Ooh, and so what happens, yes, is that suddenly this idea that nobody had ever thought of and, you know, seriously, becomes a very important topic. But it's part, again, how many times have we said that? It's all part of the power relationship between FIFA and the confederations, between FIFA and the other bodies, I would say, which compose world football. UEFA is obviously dead against the idea. FIFPro is against the idea. And I don't think it's a question of Arsene Wenger going mad. I don't think it's mad at all. I think it's a plan which is in place to generate even more income, because 92%, I believe, of the FIFA income comes directly from the men's World Cup, even if the women's World Cup share is growing all the time. So you grow more revenue. In terms of sport and football, it doesn't make any sense. The fans are dead against it, I think, all over the world. But it doesn't matter, because it's about money and it's about power. So therefore, it's going to happen.
And I think that last part, sorry, Philippe, is slightly under-communicated. I don't think most people are aware that, like you say, about 90% of FIFA's income comes from the Men's World Cup. It is what they make money out of. Everything else we hear about FIFA, like, that's where their money comes from. So it's beyond ludicrous to have Wenger saying, and I've read the articles now, it's like, this is not about money. It was like, well, the organization you work for is suggesting basically doubling something that would double their income. And it's like, oh, this has got nothing to do with money. It's like, yeah, okay, well done. I mean, it is a bit sad, because either he's naive to the point that we have to ask if he's become soft in the head, or there's something else going on, of course, with Mr. Wenger at the moment, which would be even sadder given what his legacy in general is.
That's the point, isn't it, Jordan? He's like the ultimate football purist. You know, he is someone that you just think, And I've spent a short, small time in his company, and he doesn't waste a word. You know, you hang on everything he says. He gets the game. He understands the game. And maybe we can't speak for all football fans, but I don't know anybody that the beauty of the World Cup is that it isn't that often, and it is special for that reason.
Well, listening to Philippe explaining his thoughts and how it works just then reminded me of when they've initially, the UK government put out this idea of vaccine passports, and everybody kind of went crazy about it and was really dead against it. This idea that let's just put it out there, let's just see the reaction and then finesse it down the line later on. I think a similar thing's happening here, and I think like vaccine passports, I think this actually will happen in the end. Regarding Arsene Wenger, I would like to believe that the purity of his heart and his love of football is not being tainted by financial gain here. Maybe I'm being naive here, and I'm many things, but I'm not naive. But perhaps I'm being a little bit naive as an Arsenal fan as well. But when these sorts of things come up, I tend to ask myself the question, what are the pros and cons? So if there is to be a World Cup more regular, okay, let's look at this in a balanced way. Put money to one side, because we know there's money to be made. I think we all know that. What are the pros and the cons? I'm not against the idea of having a World Cup more often, but I need to be told and sold as to why it's beneficial beyond what I already know, which is people making more money. I'm comfortable with it being every 4 years. I think I am of the school of thought there is a lot of too much football at the moment, and I'm not seeing an increase in quality as the increase in volume of games goes up. So my instinctive nature is to kind of push back against this, but I'm not overtly against it. I just need to be told more good reason as to why this is a good thing beyond people can make more money out of this.
In every proposal, when you look closely enough, there's bound to be something which is not completely crazy. Like, for example, the Super League, the proposal to cap the players' salaries, actually, that kind of made sense. And if you look at that, there's one idea of Wenger that I think is one that should be looked at, which is the fact to put aside 1 month for qualifiers, October, and to do away with friendlies completely. And I think actually, that's not stupid. I can, you know, let's have a chat about that. But it doesn't mean you have to have a World Cup every 2 years, because let's remember as well, we've got the Copa America, we've got the Euros, we've got the AFCON, we've got the Asian Cup of Nations, the Gold Cup and so forth. We've got other competitions, and we don't want player burnout, which is one of the reasons why FIFPro is dead against the idea of a 2 year cycle, especially with at the same time an increase in the size of the World Cup, because we've got to see those, you know, in conjunction. It's not just a World Cup every 2 years. It's a World Cup with even more teams. And it seems like every new edition has to have more teams. And so you end up, yes, you've got this 1 month where you should set aside for the national teams. Wenger is talking about 7 games played in 1 month, which is doable. It is doable. You might think as well, and to be the devil's advocate, and I hate myself for being the devil's advocate, that having the national teams together for a period of 1 month might actually enable managers to develop the play of those teams perhaps more than they're able to do that. Like, for example, when Gareth Southgate got his England team, I think he had 2 training sessions before they played against Hungary.
That's true.
So that side of it is not so crazy, but the other side, we've got to see it for what it is. It's about money, and it's about a power grab. And because also don't forget, and I'll end on that, this goes with the complete reorganization of the international football calendar, which in Mr. Infantino's head would also have a Super League, at least in Africa and probably elsewhere.
I've thought about a lot about this last sort of week, because I absolutely love international football. I think international football is great. I think international football is an antidote to the sort of Super League-ification of club football, which has been happening gradually, and I'm not even sure there is a fix for. There's a sort of purity to international football, and it brings out emotions in people, and it gets people together in a way club football just doesn't do. I absolutely love it. But I have found myself really annoyed that we're having an international break right now. Like, it's not the time. And I often feel that way when the international break comes around. I absolutely adore international football, but you do find yourself being a bit, yeah, it's annoying international break now. And I've thought a lot about it, and I think what it is that football is as much a soap opera as it is a sport. You know, it is about the storylines, it's about the characters, it's about what's going on in this sort of ongoing narrative of the club you follow or the country you're from or whatever, right? And the system that we have now of sort of a number of short breaks every year where the club football is put on hold and suddenly it's international football for 2 weeks, it feels like when you're watching your TV show, suddenly there's an episode where all the characters just do something completely different, not related to the ongoing narrative at all. It's like you're watching I think I may have said this on the pod before. It's like if you're watching The Wire and suddenly there's an episode where Bunk and McNulty just go fishing for the entire episode and nothing else happens. And you're like, that's not unpleasant, but it's really strange and it's not really. And the problem again with the international breaks, when they start, you're a bit sort of, yeah, okay, we're doing this again. And then you don't remember who's in charge of that team and who's doing well and what's going on. And then after a couple of games in the international break, you're kind of getting into it. Then it suddenly ends again and the club football is back and there's a few months. So I definitely like the idea of bunching the qualifiers together into one big period. So that we don't have these sort of constant interruptions, because then we can all sort of get into the mindset of now the internationals is happening, and that'll be good.
Devastating for Paul Whitehouse and Bob Mortimer that McNulty and Bunk are now on the fishing program circuit. Sorry, Jordan.
Yeah. Just finally from me, I mean, they won't do this. I'm not even sure how they would do this, but two of the three most key elements of football haven't been considered in this, the fans and the players. Have FIFA even thought about whether the players, how they feel about this? And as we all know, you know, they don't care about the fans, but you know, the football fans, do they, maybe they want more football. Maybe a lot of the football fans want this. I don't know, but it feels like they're kind of just planning this and plotting this in expensive offices and boardrooms in Switzerland without thinking about the key components of the game, which are the players and the supporters.
A question from Dave Wood says, can Jordan confirm or deny if he works for Anvisa, that branch of the Brazilian Health Authority, after two Villa players were deported?
It was me. Of course it was me, Max. Get them out. Get them out.
Well, Stephen did ask a question going, following Brazil-Argentina, has there ever been an arrest on the field of play? Philippe, I think you found one.
Oh, there have been several, actually, Max, but I think the most famous, and actually there is actually footage of this. I'll send you the link, and I think probably we should put it out so that people can enjoy it. And it was in a game which took place 1st of June 2008, a game between Nautico and Botafogo. And for Botafogo was a player called André Luiz, who'd already been booked, and he made an absolutely appalling tackle from behind on a player called Rui, and he received a second yellow card, and he was sent off, quite logically. But he started insulting, making all sorts of things with his fingers, in particular towards the fans, the opposition fans. A police officer came to him and said, you know, calm down, guy, this is not really cool. And he insulted her. And then the police came on. And when I talk about the police, it's like armed police with, you know, riot gear, helmets, and so forth. And they tried to arrest him. And there was a massive fight on the pitch, but he escaped, but they finally found him. They arrested him. So he was arrested twice, once in the field of play, once in the dressing room, and he was then taken to a police station, and he was only let go when he agreed a very strange plea. He paid the wage of 25 hospital workers at the local hospital, and he was let go.
Ben says, do we place too much value on the league in club football? Whoever wins the league this season will be the best team at beating 19 teams in the Premier League. Or put another way, the best team at beating Burnley, Norwich, Palace, Newcastle, etc., home and away. It's not common the team who wins the league gains the most points against the top six. In short, should Pep City be remembered as a good side, not a great side, because they never won a European trophy? Only won a singular FA Cup in a poor year for that competition? How many leagues would they have won if it was a playoff system for the top four? I mean, I'm inclined to say no, the league is really quite important. But Lars, your hand is raised.
I go the absolutely the other way. I think we put too much emphasis on the cup competitions and not enough on the league. because the reality of football is that it is a low-scoring game with an absolute ton of variables. So within single games, you can have very strange events happen that are almost more to do with the randomness of the sport than the quality of the teams involved. And it's something I think Jürgen Klopp once said, that in his opinion, football is the team where the less good team has the best chance of beating the better team in a one-off game. I'm not sure if that's scientifically true, but it feels like it's something that could be true. And I certainly think, we've taken it to Pep's Man City, you know, they've won three of the last four titles in the Premier League. That is a much, much, much harder thing to do than winning a single Champions League, for instance. Like, a lot of good but not great teams can fluke a Champions League, but you can't win three out of four league titles unless you are something else. Then, of course, there's a whole discussion about, you know, how they became that good and all that, but that's separate, I think.
I'm sure we'll get to that in part two. Gwigsy says, following Arsenal's poor start to the season, does Jordan feel they would benefit from a new, more dynamic manager with a proven track record in the Premier League? Someone like Dean Smith, maybe? Steven says, I have a question. I have a question for Philippe and Jordan, says Steven. Namely, what do they think has gone wrong at Arsenal? In 2019, Arsenal and Chelsea got to the final of the Europa League. The two teams were separated by only 2 points in the Premier League. Fast forward to 2021, they've become polar opposites. Who does Jordan and Philippe blame for the omni-shambles at the Emirates? Has Jordan revised his opinion about Arteta being a, quote, brilliant manager? I don't see much evidence that he knows what he's doing. Jordan Jarrett-Bryan.
I think Arsenal have been on a slide for a while, and I think that that has been centred in a combination of complacency that I think has gone back a decade, but also Arsene Wenger's desire to play by the rules. So I think him going along with financial fair play and believing in financial fair play when others maybe didn't so much, left him on the back foot. And I think that financially, the spend of Arsenal, while City and Chelsea were coming into their own, I think put them at a disadvantage. Now, I think what's happening at Arsenal is the culture has been festered in nonsense. And I think that has played itself out onto the pitch itself. But the main reason I think Arsenal are struggling right now, we can talk about Arteta's tactical and coaching prowess and how good a manager he is. And in answer to the latter part of the question, I am having doubts about whether he is good enough for this level at this stage. But I think it's far bigger than Mikel Arteta. I think it's a club that has got caught in its own mud, and I'm not quite sure if it knows how to get out of it. And I think that is because for so long, Arsene Wenger has been such a huge figure at the football club, who was fighting so many fires and fighting them very well for a very long time. It was a club that thought it could do that forever. And the minute that Arsene Wenger stepped aside, and I'll be transparent here, I was an Arsene Wenger out person long before he left, because I just felt that he was, he caught up in his own mud. I thought that when he left, a lot of the problems that he was seemingly to solve became exposed. So I think it's a lot bigger than Arteta. I think he'll be sacked at some point soon, but that for me isn't the issue, because I don't have any faith that the club know what kind of manager they want to bring in to really reboot this football club. So whether it's Arteta, Eddie Howe, or some of that ilk, I don't think the manager is the central problem here.
I mean, it's important to say that by the end, Arsene Wenger wanted two Premier League seasons every year, didn't he? And that was a big issue. He wanted to double the number of Premier League. That's what he likes to do, is just double the number of competitions. Philippe, there's the other Arsenal voice on this podcast. What do you think? Who's responsible? How does it get? As Jordan said, does anybody know how to get out of this rut?
To be honest, the state of the club at the moment, I've often compared it to a depressive state, and that, to be honest, it's like everything that happens, it is another means to convince yourself you're going further and further into this depression. There's a lack of, this is valid for everybody. It's valid for the players, it's valid for the fans. Look at, for example, Unai Emery. Everybody will agree that Unai Emery is actually a very decent manager. He's proved it. Everywhere he's been. And I would actually even say at Paris Saint-Germain, he was given an absolutely impossible hand. He was dealt an absolutely impossible hand to play with. And at Arsenal, when it finished, the way that it's going at the moment with Mikel Arteta. The problem is systemic. The problem is not just one manager. The problem is with recruitment. I mean, come on, Max. You've seen Arsenal has spent more money on this transfer window than at any other time in their history. 149 million, I believe, net more than any other club on the planet. You would think this is going to have a transformational impact on the team. I'm not so sure. And I have the feeling I'm stuck on one groove, and it's not a great groove. It's not funkadelic. It's a really horrible, plonky, plinky, heavy-arsed groove that we have been stuck in for a number of years now. And we wonder who on earth is going to play another record another day. Save me, Mr. DJ. Save me, Mr. DJ. But who is he? I don't know.
What I find fascinating with the Arsenal funk is that if you look at the sort of brains trusts that were meant to take the club forward post-Wenger, it was, you know, you had Ivan Gazidis in charge there. You had Unai Emery as the coach, and sort of Sven Mislintat was going to be the new transfer guru. Like, Unai Emery, as you say, is doing well at Villarreal, and I don't think anyone can doubt that he's a pretty good manager, certainly better than what it seemed like at Arsenal. Sven Mislintat is now at Stuttgart doing really well, creating a young and vibrant team there. And Ivan Gazidis, as much as he's been ridiculed, has played a big part in turning, you know, Milan into what looks like a serious team again. So these are clearly people who do know a thing or two about running a football club. It's just that when they were at Arsenal, it just didn't work at all. Maybe the club is doomed, Philippe. Maybe there's a curse.
That's a good point that kind of Lars ends on there. I mean, I think that, to answer the question again to the questioner, Arteta, I think, is a good coach. I have seen things in him that I believe will make him a good coach. Maybe it's too soon, too big a job for him now. My big issue is, if you're going to bring in a rookie manager, and he was a rookie manager, if you're going to take a gamble, and I was all up for taking a gamble, I was all up for it, you need to surround him with experience. You need to surround him with people who actually have proven in this game what their jobs are. And I think that you've got too many rookies. Edu, okay, he's got a bit of experience back in Brazil. But I think Arteta's been exposed by the lack of experience around him. I don't know who the people on the bench who he's talking to with notepads and iPads. I don't know who these people are. So I think that is where Arteta's being doubly failed. A, he's lacking experience himself, but the people around him as well. And just super quickly as well, I remember Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher on Sky once saying something about things in football are never quite as good as you think, and they're never quite as bad as you think. Now, at Arsenal, they're pretty, pretty bad, but it might just take them to stumble on a fluky transfer of a player that can just reinvigorate this football club. I'm clutching here, granted, but it's not looking great for Arsenal Football Club at the moment. It's very, very sad to see.
On Monday's pod, there will be a full review of Arsenal's 2-0 defeat to Norwich.
Matthias Norman scoring on his debut. You watch.
And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with some serious questions. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. The panel complained in the break that we'd done serious and they wanted to get on with the nonsense. Okay, I want to do a couple of serious questions, and then we'll move on to the enjoyable stuff. Because I think you need to have both conversations, right? That's why I think why people like this podcast. Ben says, myself and a number of friends in my circle happen to be Spurs fans, are vehemently opposed to the Qatar World Cup on the way it was awarded, the problematic human rights situation in Qatar, and perhaps most importantly, the appalling conditions and treatments of the migrant workers preparing the stadia for the World Cup and the deaths and injuries many of them have suffered. We're intent on boycotting the World Cup. I would like to know, A, if you think the feeling is widely shared by normal football fans, B, whether you think such a boycott could have any impact. If so, what ways could we do it? And C, how you feel about covering, as you obviously must, such a contentious and morally dubious event. Philippe.
The opposition is real. It's not necessarily as widespread as you would hope it to be. It's certainly the part of the world where there's the most opposition is Scandinavia. Lars will explain to us what happened in June when a motion was put forward by a number of clubs, and there was a special convention of the Norwegian FA, and there were a lot, I think, of arms twisted, wrists slapped, to get everybody, I mean, basically people being whipped into not asking for a boycott, but it was very close. There was a petition as well launched in Denmark. Just published in the Players' Tribune an absolutely remarkable column by Tim Sparv, the captain of the Finland national football team, honestly, I should just direct people to read it, but which shows how players can address that as well. There is, of course, people are talking about it in Britain, but I would say that's pretty much at the moment the extent of it. If I look at what's being, for example, in Latin countries, by which I mean Mediterranean countries, there's no debate. In the US, there's no debate. In France, there is a little bit of a debate, but PSG's situation is one of such dominance that this debate is restricted to it basically descends into whataboutery very, very quickly. So which is a concern. What is less concerning, Max, is, and I mean, we could talk for hours, and we probably will talk for hours about this. It seems to me that it's growing, because I was fearing myself that there would be some kind of Qatar fatigue, coming in, and people thinking, well, actually, we've talked about all that. And there have been all these announcements that the situation of the migrant workers has improved and kafala has been ended. But in fact, there are actually people carrying on talking about it, and new people coming out and talking about it, but genuinely not enough. And it's restricted really to a small part of the world. Scandinavia, Germany, Britain, and that's about it for the time being. And I might be a bit, all my apologies if I forget anybody. There have been individuals who have been speaking out here and there, but the only countries where there is a genuine debate about it is that. As to what we will do for ourselves as journalists for Qatar 2022, it's a question I'm asking myself, and I'm sure that we're all asking ourselves at the moment. And I will just say this, as far as I'm concerned, I see my role at the moment in highlighting the issues around the World Cup, both the way it's been given and what is happening in the country and what can be done, and use that particular competition to highlight, to put the sporting side of it completely aside at the moment, and to concentrate on what are the real questions about Qatar and more generally the way that football sees its relationship with regimes of that kind.
Of course, I've got to read out what FIFA and the Qatari government say. So here are their statements. Committee organising the World Cup in Qatar, from a Guardian investigation in 2021, said, "We deeply regret all of these tragedies and investigated each incident to ensure lessons were learnt. We've always maintained transparency around this issue, dispute inaccurate claims around the number of workers who've died on our projects." A spokesperson for FIFA said, "It's fully committed to protecting the rights of workers on FIFA projects. With the very stringent health and safety measures on site, the frequency of accidents on FIFA World Cup construction sites has been low when compared to other major construction projects around the world." The Qatar government says the number of deaths, which it does not dispute, is proportionate to the size of the migrant workforce, and that the figures include white-collar workers who have died naturally after living in Qatar for many years. It also says only 20% of expats from the countries in question are employed in construction, and that work-related deaths in this sector accounted for fewer than 10% of fatalities within this group. Some quotes from them. "The mortality rate among these communities is within the expected range for the size and demographics of the population. However, every lost life is a tragedy. No effort is spared in trying to prevent every death in our country." That's a Qatari government spokesperson. The official added that all citizens and foreign nationals have access to free first-class healthcare, and that there's been a steady decline in the mortality rate among guest workers over the past decade due to health and safety reforms to the labour system. I will cover it, presuming the Guardian haven't fired me by then. And is my justification, which would be sort of similar to that, to say, listen, I will use that platform. We'll obviously talk about the football that happens on the pitch. We will try and find the right balance. In the build-up to the tournament, we'll talk about it a lot, you know, how it happened, the treatment of the migrant workers. Am I giving myself a pass there by saying that therefore I can earn a living, do it, talk about it and enjoy the football? Or is that not good enough?
Max, I'm sorry. I interrupted you here because I think that, no, if you do that, that's fine. That's what we didn't do for Russia. That's what the shame, I think, about the coverage of the Russian World Cup was. There were very, very few voices which were actually talking about what was going on in Putin's Russia. Very, very few voices. Everybody saying, oh, it's a wonderful country. Yes, it is a wonderful country. Oh, they're wonderful people. Of course, they're wonderful people. A country is not a regime. There's a huge difference. It's an essential difference between the two. And with Russia, we only spoke about the country. There was hardly any word said about the regime. There was hardly word said about the repression of the opposition, the role in Chechnya and all this sort of thing. Very little. So let's make sure for Qatar it doesn't happen.
Are either of you conflicted?
I am, yes. And I think your point, Max, there is a really interesting one about, do we give ourselves a pat on the back by saying, well, I'm going to cover it, but I'm going to call them out as well, so I'm fine. I think that's an interesting point. I've just got back from Japan, and all my reports, I spoke really, you know, I spoke often about how the Japanese had embraced the Paralympics, how they loved having us there. It was a great Games. But I also had to reflect in my reports, there's still a big issue with Japanese people and disability. Some people in Japan still feel like they are being hidden away from society. And I think that social experience of what's happening in the country, I think should be reflected alongside the sport as well. Whether that's enough to justify me going there and seeing a fantastic World Cup or Paralympic Games or not, I'm not quite sure. I think it's also an interesting dilemma for England fans, because England, some may disagree, they have a chance of winning a World Cup. And does that trump the idea of, yeah, but I don't want to be a part of that and in a country that are doing things that I know are morally wrong? So I think a lot of England fans will tell themselves that they're gonna go to this Qatar World Cup purely because they want to be there when England potentially win a World Cup. But that, does that mean it's right being there and being part of it? Of course it doesn't. I'm having strong thoughts about whether my participation there is justified or not.
It's a similar question, but slightly different. It's from Sebastian in Adelaide, who says, why is it, do the panel believe, that players, and it's interesting you mentioned the Finnish captain there, but players in general don't seem to have the same moral quandaries that fans do surrounding clubs owned by oligarchs, nation states with questionable human rights records?
I have some sympathy with the players in this regard, because, you know, it's a short career and I think they are justified in trying to get to the highest sporting level they can and maximize their income within that time frame. I think it's very easy for us to judge from the outside. But I mean, we had a case of a player from Norway who went to play in the Middle East after being quite sort of vocal about social issues. And but then it's very easy to snipe from the sidelines. But when you're in that situation and you can secure a financial future for your family, it becomes a little bit different. And I feel like it's more an issue of the sport as a whole should be looking at who are allowed to use the sport to glorify themselves. You know, what sources of income are we actually comfortable with? Where do we draw the line? But for me personally, I think that's more of a question for the administrators of the sport and for the sport itself than for the players within it.
Yeah, there is another thing we should take into consideration here. In his column, actually, this is something that Tim Sparf speaks about directly, and he explains how it is possible for players to be in a way ignorant of what is going on in the world at large. They live in a bubble from the age of 14, 15, 16, most of them. So it's possible. But I have an example. Obviously, I cannot name names, but I am pretty sure of my facts, of a pretty big player who is employed by a pretty big club, who did actually an interview in which he actually put some of these questions directly and said that he was fed up with it. The interview was then passed on. There was a right of, not reply, but they wanted to read the interview before it was published. The club insisted that these passages were removed from the interview. This is the kind of world in which we live. And I'm talking about a pretty big player in a pretty big club. If this had come out, it would have created, I think, quite a stir. But it is in the interest, I believe, of the established powers in football that these things are not, you know, taken out.
Joe says, I have a question inspired by Trent Alexander-Arnold's puzzling cameo for England against Andorra in central midfield. What are the most disastrous examples of square pegs in round holes the panel have seen? Preferably, in Philippe's case, something that made him incredibly angry.
It didn't make me angry. It made me laugh. And I think last... Might be able to guess what it was.
Rabiot.
Is it? It's not Martin. It's not Martin Keown at left back.
No, we surely we have to be going to Adrian Rabiot, left wing back here.
We should go to the Rabiot question. You don't have to.
Oh man, really? Do we have to?
Well, Tom says, I didn't understand the comments of Rabiot is Rabiot. What can I say? He's Rabiot. I can speak
about
Adrian Rabiot for a long time, but I won't.
I've got nothing to add to that. A rose is a rose is a rose, and I don't need to elaborate. I just have a problem. I go into shock, basically. It's a kind of allergy. So there you go. We all have a player like that. So I suffer from rabiosis and...
Rabiosis.
and you probably all have a player like this who infuriates you. Completely, actually, probably wrongly for the wrong reasons, but that's it.
Rabiosis sounds like some kind of deeply unpleasant trouser disease.
Yeah. Jordan?
No, so mine was weirdly Arteta. So despite the sport supporting him hardcore as a manager, as a player, I couldn't stand him at Arsenal. Couldn't stand him.
But again, it's worth reiterating before we leave the realm of sort of tactical dunderheadedness. France did go out of the World Cup because they lined up inexplicably in a 3-4-3 with Rabiot as left wing-back, which he's never done before, and Pavard as a right wing-back, not a wing-back at all, and Pogba in a midfield too, which has been done 100 times before and never really works very well. So Didier Deschamps, well done.
Gareth says, could you ask Philippe if he has any more info on Jean-Pierre Adams, who passed away after a 39-year coma, please? His career and potential, how he's remembered in France. Thank you. We talked about this before, didn't we? I can't quite remember why we did, but yeah, he sadly passed away. It's a sort of beautiful love story, a tragedy and a beautiful love story.
Yes, I mean, he was a very important player. I mean, perhaps not very well known abroad, but for us... children of my generation, he was really, really very important because he was part of what we called, and those were the days, we called it the Black Guard at the time. And we had Marius Trésor and Jean-Pierre Adams, two completely different players, but who genuinely formed one of the great central defensive partnerships in European football at the time. What happened after his career waned a little bit, he started to go into coaching, and through a absolutely a dramatic and completely random set of circumstances, was taken to hospital to have a minor operation. The hospital staff at the time was not the best qualified to do this minor operation. And the anesthetist basically just got it wrong, and so wrong that he nearly died, and he slipped into a coma. And that was back in 1982. And his wife, Bernadette, that had two young children, decided to take him home. She was told that we could put him in an old people's home. And she thought, no, if you put him there, he'll die. And so she put him in his room at her home, at their home. And she cared for him, I don't know, I mean, every day of his life for 39 years. I mean, it's... what a woman. I mean... If you can inspire such love and devotion, you really haven't missed your, you've really, you know, your life has been a success. And he did. And so we're terribly sad. And in a way, it's perhaps I mean, 39 years, he was 73 years of age. Nobody gave him a chance to live that long, but he did. And thanks to this extraordinary woman.
Beautifully said, Philippe. And we'll be back in a minute. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly, which producer Ian has entitled Quality Nonsense. Jack says, following the chat about having two historic teams play against each other, if the pod could create the ultimate football ground from any historic stands, what would they go for? Mine would be the Holt End at Villa Park, the Kop at Anfield circa 78, the Kippax at Main Road, with the other side filled in with the loudest part of La Bombonera. I will go... I want one end of the San Siro. At the other end, I think we'll take the wall, the Dortmund wall. And then on the one side, I'm having the Habin stand from Cambridge United, where really everyone goes to moan. And the other is the side at Sinsel Bank at Lincoln, where they've designed it in such a way that they've got the right amount of stand, but it's not long enough So it's really high and really short, and it doesn't reach either end of the pitch. So I'm going San Siro, Dortmund, the Abbey, Lincoln.
Wow. Tough act to follow, Max. Tough act to follow.
Well, I just came up with that. I didn't think about it.
All right, I'll go. I'm going to go for the grounds where I've just heard that it's been the loudest and the most raucous.
Okay.
So I'll pick four. So I'll go one corner, Stadio Olimpico in Rome. I saw a derby there a couple of times when I lived in Italy, and I've just never seen. It's just bizarre, but a beautiful bizarre. I'm going Selhurst Park, that corner that we all know where they just bang that drum for 90 minutes, even if they're 7-0 down. I'm going Boca Juniors. I was there once for a game, and it was just my head just got blown off with it was just insane. Loved it. And the fourth corner, I'd go for Wembley, because you need one kind of like down corner. You need like one corner that's not quite raucous, and I think Wembley's horrible. even when there's a good game going on, I never understand when people say Wembley's a great atmosphere. Wembley's horrible. This the new Wembley I'm talking about. So I think you need one corner that's not quite kicking off. That'll be my fourth corner.
It's good. I enjoy it. I quite like the idea of taking that stand at Galatasaray and just sticking it in the Emirates. You know, on a Thursday night when they're back in the Europa League, just to see what happens there.
There's no need for that, Max.
I should take out the Dortmund wall because I've never been there. So I need to think of a fourth. I need to think of a fourth wall that I can break. Should we move on, or Lars, have you got? Are you thinking?
Just thinking a little bit. Okay, fair. Yeah, slightly goofy. Let's do. Let's have the yellow wall down one end. Let's have the Holt end, because that's a great suggestion. Villa Park is a fabulous stadium. I look forward to going there again.
Yeah.
Let's have the West End from White Hart Lane, just for sheer bias reasons. And just because it's goofy and cool, and I'd like to see it more often, the Rock Face from Braga's home ground.
Oh, that is nice. I suppose it's different if we're building the most beautiful.
Well, I just love stadiums that have got something completely unique that you never see anywhere else, and you cannot beat the shared sort of face of rock that's down the end of Braga Stadium. It's really strange, and I want to see more of that. Financially not great for this stadium, obviously, taking one stand away entirely, but there we are.
It's a really tough one because it all depends on the game, because San Siro is absolutely astonishing, but it's not always astonishing. And in a way, my perfect stadium is the stadium I would take everywhere, because it's the stadium I enjoyed the greatest atmosphere of my life, which was, unbelievably enough, Craven Cottage. I've spoken about that game many times, Fulham against Juventus. For me, it was the perfect stadium, the perfect match, the perfect public, everything. So, and I love that stadium so much.
All hail Clint Dempsey, eh? What a chip. What a finish that is.
Oh. And all hail this magnificent stadium. Let's hope it's as great as it's ever been when the new stand is finally up.
Eric writes, slightly in response to Wilson's detective squad, I wanted to ask Philippe who he'd put on a squad consisting entirely of philosophers. Monty Python did a sketch. They put Heidegger and Wittgenstein up front for Germany, which seems mad to me. Both seem like Steven Bergwijn figures who are capable of impressive work on the ball but can't convert that into goals. What is Philippe's team of philosophers? This is going to be tough for me because I don't know enough about philosophy, but it will entertain our intellectual audience.
I spent some time thinking about it.
Brilliant. Of course you did.
And I have to say that those two don't make my 11. They actually don't even make the 23. I think in goal, fairly obviously, it's Albert Camus, because he was a goalkeeper anyway. And his substitute would be Jacques Derrida, because Derrida also wanted to be a goalkeeper. My central defense is, I'm very happy with it, it's Leibniz and Kant. Now, those two together, I can tell you, you are not going to go past. At the beginning, I thought maybe I should put Hegel, but he overcomplicates stuff. He plays too much from the back. So, no Hegel. Fullbacks, two French guys, really quick on the ball, hard to read. So Jacques Derrida on the left and Gilles Deleuze on the right. A very strong double pivot in midfield with Plato and Aristotle. I mean, you know, you have to go for the tried and tested, Plato and Aristotle, no problem. Number 10 has to be Spinoza, because you have to have somebody who sees everything at the same time, and he could do that. And to go forward, I decided I needed some unpredictability. So I went for Søren Kierkegaard on the left side of midfield, the first existentialist, completely unpredictable. And on the right-hand side of my midfield, Nietzsche, of course, pure dynamite. You don't know what to expect. And as a center forward, I had to go for a pre-Socratic because they are also incredibly difficult to read, and it's all fragmentary and all this sort of thing. And I chose Empedocles. And I thought long and hard about Karl Marx, but too temperamental, would probably get a red card.
You don't want him distributing possession very evenly in midfield.
No.
All Sunday League players know you need at least one Kant in the back four. As you were reading that, I was thinking, they're not getting this on Five Live Football Daily.
Max, you're better than that, Max. You're better than that, Max. Come on.
I don't know if I am. Philippe, that was so beautiful. Craig says, if you had to select one player cloned 10 times to play in every starting position of a team, who would you choose? Personally, I think a team of 11 Kyle Walkers would beat Newcastle United. Who would the pod pick? Can be past or present.
If you want to have the best team of all time, a team of Hullits. He was at one point was one of the best central defenders, the best midfielder, and the best centre forward. So a team of Ruud Gullit's. And I'm sure he would be pretty decent in goal as well.
I've heard Philippe argue in the past that a team of James Milner's would be tremendous, which I think is a good shout. Certainly James Milner over a couple of years ago. I would like to see a team made up entirely of Tanguy Ndombele just before the vibes.
I was about to say.
It would make no sense, but I would like to see it. It can play in my very strange three-sided stadium.
Well, the team of Kyle Walker might be Newcastle United, but what if the team of Newcastle United was made of 11 Saint-Maximin?
A team of David Luiz's would be absolutely... there's so much, much hair. Fellaini. What about a team of Fellainis?
You worry about mobility there. A team of Luiz would be chaotic, but possibly quite good. I mean, I feel like he can do a lot of things on a football pitch.
I want to see a team of Ian Robbins, because defending that would be really, really easy. You just show them to one side of the pitch.
He keeps going. The left winger keeps just running off the pitch. What are they doing? Get back on the pitch, Arjen.
I would like to see, I mean, again, I know I'm not really getting the spirit of the question, but an entire team of Dimitar Berbatovs would be quite something. Just hanging around, smoking.
So nice. Harvey says, can everyone please recommend a football-related book? Preferably not an autobiography, unless they make for particularly exciting reading. Does anyone have a football book that they would... could recommend to the listeners?
Roy Keane's last one for me.
Yeah, tell us more, Jordan.
It's really insightful. It's very Roy Keane, but it just gives you an idea of what the multiple Man United teams that he was in that won and lost was like. He's very honest about his failings. He's very brutal about some of the other people's failings. He talks about the whole Ireland debacle. I learned a little bit more about him, because the Roy Keane you see on TV, that's not the real Roy Keane for me. I think it's an element of Roy Keane, but I think it's heightened because of television. But I think you get a real sense of who Roy Keane really is in his books. And he's very honest about his failings. And I like people that can be self-deprecating, and I think he's very good in the book at that.
For people who want to understand how FIFA works and the depth to which it plunged, I think Ken Bensinger's Red Card is an absolute masterpiece. And read like a, it reads like a thriller. I can't put this book down. And it's the story of how the FBI tracked down the people who were basically stealing money from football and got them in the end. And it's absolutely remarkable. So Ken Bensinger, Red Card, which was a winner of the Football of the Year, Football Book of the Year award, together with Uli Hesse, Superbs, which makes me think, I mean, actually, there are so many, bloody hell. Let's keep to Ken Bensinger's Red Card.
So, I feel like we can say this because he's not here, but Wilson's books are very good. And the Inverting the Pyramid is actually a very good book. And I feel like it's worth bringing up because we make fun of it a lot on this pod. if you haven't read Inverting the Pyramids, it's not as boring as Barry makes it out to be. And it is a very good sort of grounding. And, you know, it really helps to understand history to understand the present, right? So if you go through the way tactics and football has evolved over the years, your understanding of what you're seeing when you watch football now will be increased. So if you are interested enough, I do actually recommend reading that, but don't tell Jonathan I said that. Secondly, if you haven't read the Robert Enke book, you should. And it is one of those where I think everyone will have heard that it's great, but you might feel like it's the kind of story that you don't want to spend a lot of hours of your life on, because it seems very sad, and it is that, but it is an absolutely extraordinary book, and I think it is worth visiting. And it is obviously very tragic, but there are parts that's very uplifting as well. And, you know, it's a word we throw around, but I think it's important that we understand a little bit better about mental health and this sort of thing. So do read A Life Too Short, The Tragedy of Robert Enke, if you have the chance.
Thank you, chaps. Andy's been in touch to say, further to your shovel discussion the other day and the idea of Antonio Rudiger using shovels for shin pads so that he can make it more easier for him to dig up the penalty spot when he's trying to do a bit of S-housery. Andy says, I'm a gardener at the Botanic Gardens in Bristol. We call a spade, garden fork and shovel a knife, fork and spoon. That's a good way to think of how they're used. Thank you. And we've got some praise emails. We've got loads of people saying nice things. There are three really lovely ones. I think I'll read one, because if you've sent a message saying thank you, I enjoy the pod, we really do appreciate those. This is from James, who says, Dear Max, Barry and team, I first came to the pod at the time that you took over, Max, so I'm a purist. Very good. I listened to you, quote, reluctantly reading out emails in recent times. I do not send this to you with that intent. I just send it because I want to say a simple thank you. I always listen during the first half of my daily 4:30 a.m. morning exercise. Blimey. A 15-kilometre street run in one of Sydney's northern suburbs. I've been running now for 4 years, following double umbilical hernia surgery and a life-changing health kick where I gave up the grog, changed my diet. I've managed to lose 40 kilos. Well done to you. The pod gives me great joy. I emigrated here 20 years ago, age 26. Having met an Aussie and fallen in love, I moved away from all my family and friends in England. In the early years, I got up at all hours of the morning, dialing home at 3 a.m. to talk about Ryder Cup miracles, life-changing Ashes wins, and the obligatory major tournament penalty shootout eliminations of our round ball team. But life moves on. I'm 45 now. I have a family, and whilst the love is still there, I don't get up at all hours to watch the Premier League, although I'd say a large part of that relates to me being a Newcastle fan. I've begun to rely more and more on you guys to thrice weekly keep me abreast of the comings and goings and ultimately guide and inform me what highlights to retrospectively seek out and watch, always doing so with great camaraderie and humour. The passing of time has seen me naturally drift away from all those friends I grew up with. I've never replaced them. At this point in my life, there's my wife and my 9-year-old daughter. Sport is my me time, and you lot on the pod are part of that. Thanks. While listening this morning, one of my regular laughs came as Barry recanted the story about the bloke in Vera who thinks Wilson is a twat. However, immediately afterwards, I burst into tears. I haven't seen my wife or daughter for a couple of days. My daughter's currently in hospital, recovering from surgery. Only one parent is able to be admitted with her because of COVID. It was a successful operation. She should be fine. I know why I cried this morning. It was always going to happen. It's the moment I chose to cry that's prompted me to write to you. It's because you have become some of my mates. And like the best of friends, you're always there to uplift my spirits. I love you all. But if I was to call out one highlight, it would be any time there's banter with Mark Langdon regarding eating habits. The best vessel for butter, conversation being the pinnacle. Reading this email back, it seems a little silly to have blurted all this out to you. But I'm going to hit send, if only to help you, Max, waste 2 minutes during his quarantine in this wonderful city. Thanks, everyone, for being there when I've needed you most. No, thank you, James. And thank you to everybody who sent lovely emails like that. They do make a difference. Yes, Jordan?
Can I just say, he started off by saying he didn't want a shout-out. He blatantly wanted a shout-out.
No, I know.
And that's fine. That's totally fine. That's totally fine. No.
I believe James.
You're savaging this lovely listener.
As if he was
some kind of Aston Villa manager.
Yeah, he's not even a Villa fan, you know? But no, look, we do appreciate them, because it's nice to know that people actually listen. So like those emails, footballweekly@theguardian.com, we read them all. We send them to Jordan and he gives a cynical view of all of them. The rest of us have hearts. And there'll be another panel of big-hearted panellists on Thursday. But for the time being, thank you, Philippe.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Jordan.
Anytime, pal.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.